She doesn't belong to anyone, Kaz said, feeling the singe of that angry white flame. But we'll all be back at the Slat soon enough. Actually, Jesper would be headed out of the city with his father, Nina would be off to Rafka, Inej would be on a ship under her own command, and Kaz would be getting ready to split from Haskell forever. But the old man would have his Kruga to comfort him.
Cocky little bastard, growled Haskell.
Cocky little bastard who's about to make you one of the richest bosses in the barrel.
Get out of my way, boy! I'm late for my game!
Hope the cards are hot. Kaz moved aside. But you may want these. He held out his hand. 6 bullets lay in his gloved palm, in case of a tussle. Haskell whisked the pistol from his pocket and flipped open the barrel. It was empty.
You little...
Then Haskell barked a laugh and plucked the bullets from Kaz's hand, shaking his head.
You've got the devil's own blood in you, boy. Go get my money.
And then some, murmured Kaz as he tipped his hat and limped back down the alley to the gondol. Kaz kept sharp, relaxing only slightly when the boat slid past the boundaries of the barrel and into the quieter waters that bordered the financial district. Here the streets were nearly empty, and the Stadwatch presence was thinner. As the gondol passed beneath Leadbridge, he glimpsed a shadow separating itself from the railing. A moment later, Inej joined him in the narrow boat. He was tempted to steer them back to Black Vale. He'd barely slept in days, and his leg had never fully recovered from what he'd put it through at the ice court. Eventually, his body was going to stop taking orders. As if she could read his mind, Inej said,
I can handle the surveillance. I'll meet you back on the island.
Like hell. She wasn't going to be rid of him that easily.
What direction do you want to approach Van Eck's house from? Let's start at the Church of Barter. We can get eyes on Van Eck's house from the roof.
Kaz wasn't thrilled to hear it, but he took them up Burr's Canal, past the exchange and the grand facade of the Geldrenner Hotel, where Jesper's father was probably snoring soundly in his suite. They docked the gondol near the church. The glow of candlelight spilled from the doors of the main cathedral, left open and unlocked at all hours, welcoming those who wished to offer prayers to Gazan. Inej could have climbed the outer walls with little effort, and Kaz might have managed it, but he wasn't going to test himself on a night when his leg was screaming with every step. He needed access to one of the chapels.
You don't have to come up, Inej said, as they crept along the perimeter and located one of the chapel doors.
Kaz ignored her and swiftly picked the lock. They slipped inside the darkened chamber, then took the stairs up 2 flights, the chapel stacked one on top of another like a layered cake, each commissioned by a separate merchant family of Kirch. One more lock to pick, and they were scaling another damn staircase. This one curled in a tight spiral up to a hatch in the roof. The Church of Barter was built on the plan of Gazan's hand, the vast cathedral located in the palm, with 5 stubby naves radiating along the 4 fingers and thumb, each fingertip terminating in a stack of chapels. They'd climbed the chapels at the tip of the pinky, and now cut down to the roof at the main cathedral, and then up the length of Gazan's ring finger, picking their way along a jagged mountain range of slippery gables and narrow stone spines.
Why do gods always like to be worshipped in high places?
Kaz muttered.
It's men who seek grandeur, Inej said, springing nimbly along as if her feet knew some secret topography. The saints hear prayers wherever they're spoken.
And answer them according to their moods?
What you want and what the world needs are not always in accord, Kaz. Praying and wishing are not the same thing.
But they're equally useless.
Kaz bit back the reply. He was too focused on not plummeting to his death to properly engage in an argument. At the tip of the ring finger, they stopped and took in the view. To the southwest, they could see the high spires of the cathedral, the exchange, the glittering clock tower of the Geldrenner Hotel, and the long ribbon of the Burrs Canal flowing beneath Zents Bridge. But if they looked east, this particular rooftop gave them a direct view of the Geldstraat, the Geld Canal beyond, and Van Eck's stately home.
It was a good vantage point to observe the security Van Eck had put in place around the house and on the canal. But it wouldn't give them all the information they needed.
"We're going to have to get closer," said Kaz.
"I know," said Inej, drawing a length of rope from her tunic and looping it over one of the roof's finials. "It will be faster and safer for me to case Van Eck's house on my own. Give me a half hour. By the time you make it back to the gondola, I'll have all the information we need." He was going to kill her.
"You dragged me up here for nothing."
"Your pride dragged you up here. If Van Eck senses anything amiss tonight, it's all over. This isn't a two-person job, and you know it."
"Inej, my future is riding on this too, Kaz.
I don't tell you how to pick locks or put together a plan. This is what I'm good at, so let me do my job."
She yanked the rope taut.
"And just think of all the time you'll have for prayer and quiet contemplation on the way down."
She vanished over the side of the chapel.
Kaz stood there, staring at the place she'd been only seconds before. She tricked him. The decent, honest, pious wraith had outsmarted him. He turned to look back at the long expanse of roof he was going to have to traverse to get back to the boat.
"Curse you and all your saints," he said to no one at all,
then realized he was smiling. Kaz was in a decidedly less amused frame of mind by the time he sank into the gondola. He didn't mind that she duped him. He just hated that she was right. He knew perfectly well that he was in no shape to try to slink into Van Eck's house blind tonight. It wasn't a two-person job, and it wasn't the way they operated. She was the Wraith, the Barrel's best thief of secrets. Gathering intelligence without being spotted was her specialty, not his. He could also admit that he was grateful to just sit for a moment, stretch out his leg, as water lapped gently at the sides of the canal. So why had he insisted that he accompany her? That was dangerous thinking. The kind of thinking that had gotten Inej captured in the first place.
"I can best this," Kaz told himself.
By midnight tomorrow, Kuwei would be on his way out of Kedderdam. In a matter of days, they would have their reward. Inej would be free to pursue her dream of hunting slavers, and he'd be rid of this constant distraction. He would start a new gang, one built from the youngest, deadliest members of the dregs. He'd rededicate himself to the promise he'd made to Geordi's memory. The painstaking task of pulling Pekka Rollins' life apart, piece by piece. And yet, his eyes kept drifting to the walkway beside the canal, his impatience growing. He was better than this. Waiting was the part of the criminal life so many people got wrong. They wanted to act instead of hold fast and gather information. They wanted to know instantly without having to learn. Sometimes the trick to getting the best of a situation was just to wait. If you didn't like the weather, you didn't rush into the storm. You waited until it changed. You found a way to keep from getting wet. Brilliant, thought Kaz. So where the hell is she? A few long minutes later, she dropped soundlessly into the gondola.
Tell me, he said as he set them moving down the canal.
Alice is still in the same room on the second floor. There's a guard posted outside her door.
The office?
Same location, right down the hall. He's had Skylar locks installed on all of the house's exterior windows. Kaz blew out an annoyed breath. Is that a problem? She asked.
No. A Skylar lock won't stop any pick worth of stones, but they're time-consuming.
I couldn't make sense of them, so I had to wait for one of the kitchen staff to open the back door.
He'd done a shoddy job of teaching her to pick locks. She could master a Skylar if she put her mind to it.
They were taking deliveries, Inej continued. From the little bit I was able to hear, they're preparing for a meeting tomorrow night with the Merchant Council.
Makes sense, said Kaz.
He'll act the role of the distraught father and get them to add more Stodwatch to the search.
Will they oblige? They have no reason to deny him. And they're all getting fair warning to sweep their mistresses or whatever else they don't want discovered in a raid under the rug.
The Barrel won't go easy.
No, said Kaz, as the gondola slid past the shallow sandbar that abutted Black Vale and into the island's mists. No one wants the merchants poking around in our business. Any notion of what time this little meeting of the council will take place?
The cooks were making noises about setting a full table for dinner. Could make for a good distraction. Exactly. This was them at their best, with nothing but the job between them, working together free of complications. He should leave it at that, but he needed to know.
You said Van Eck didn't hurt you. Tell me the truth.
They'd reached the shelter of the willows. Inej kept her eyes on the droop of their white branches.
He didn't.
They climbed out of the gondola, made sure it was thoroughly camouflaged, and picked their way up the shore. Kaz followed Inej, waiting, letting her weather change. The moon was starting to set, limning the graves of Black Veil, a miniature skyline etched in silver. Her braid had come uncoiled down her back. He imagined wrapping it around his hand, rubbing his thumb over the pattern of its plaits. And then what? He shoved the thought away. When they were only a few yards from the stone hull, Inej halted and watched the mists wreathing the branches.
He was going to break my legs, she said. Smash them with a mallet so they'd never heal.
Thoughts of moonlight and silken hair evaporated in a black bolt of fury. Kaz saw Inej tug on the sleeve of her left forearm, where the menagerie tattoo had once been. He had the barest inkling of what she'd endured there. But he knew what it was to feel helpless. And Van Eck had managed to make her feel that way again. Kaz was going to have to find a new language of suffering to teach that smug merch son of a bitch. Jesper and Nina were right. Inej needed rest and a chance to recover after the last few days. He knew how strong she was, but he also knew what captivity meant to her.
If you're not up for the job, I'm up for the job, she said, her back still to him.
The silence between them was dark water. He could not cross it. He couldn't walk the line between the decency she deserved and the violence this path demanded. If he tried, it might get them both killed. He could only be who he truly was, a boy who had no comfort to offer. So he would give her what he could.
I'm going to open Van Eck up, he said quietly. I'm going to give him a wound that can't be sewn shut, that he'll never recover from. The kind that can't be healed.
The kind you endured?
Yes. It was a promise. It was an admission.
She took a shaky breath. The words came like a string of gunshots, rapid fire, as if she resented the very act of speaking them.
I didn't know if you would come.
Kaz couldn't blame Van Eck for that. Kaz had built that doubt in her with every cold word and small cruelty.
We're your crew, Inej. We don't leave our own at the mercy of merch scum.
It wasn't the answer he wanted to give. It wasn't the answer she wanted. When she turned to him, her eyes were bright with anger.
He was going to break my legs, she said,
her chin held high, the barest quaver in her voice.
Would you have come for me then, Kaz? When I couldn't scale a wall or walk a tightrope? When I wasn't the Wraith anymore?
Dirty hands would not. The boy who could get them through this, get their money, keep them alive, would do her the courtesy of putting her out of her misery, then cut his losses and move on.
I would come for you, he said.
And when he saw the wary look she shot him, he said it again.
I would come for you. And if I couldn't walk, I'd crawl to you, and no matter how broken we were, we'd fight our way out together, knives drawn, pistols blazing. Because that's what we do. We never stop fighting.
The wind rose. The boughs of the willows whispered. A sly, gossiping sound. Kaz held her gaze, saw the moon reflected there. Twin scythes of light. She was right to be cautious. Even of him. Especially of him. Cautious was how you survived. At last she nodded, the smallest dip of her chin. They returned to the tomb in silence. The willows murmured on.
13. Nina. Nina woke well before dawn. As usual, her first conscious thought was of Perem. And as usual, she had no appetite. The ache for the drug had nearly driven her mad last night. Trying to use her power when the Kirgud soldiers attacked had left her desperate for Perem. And she'd spent the long hours tossing and turning, digging bloody half-moons into her palms. She felt wretched this morning. And yet a sense of purpose made it easier to rise from her bed. The need for Perem had dimmed something in her. And sometimes Nina was afraid that whatever spark had gone out would never return. But today, though her bones hurt and her skin felt dry, and her mouth tasted like an oven that needed cleaning, she felt hopeful. Inej was back. They had a job, and she was going to do some good for her people, even if she had to blackmail Kaz Brekker into being a decent person to manage it. Matthias was already up, seeing to their weapons. Nina stretched and yawned, adding a little extra arch to her back. Pleased at the way his gaze darted over her figure before guiltily jumping back to the rifle he was loading. Gratifying. She'd practically thrown herself at him the other day. If Matthias didn't want to take advantage of the offer, she could make damn sure he regretted it. The others were awake and moving around the tomb as well. Everyone except Jesper, who was still snoring contentedly, his long legs sticking out from beneath a blanket. Inej was making tea. Kaz was sitting at the table trading sketches back and forth with Wylan, as Kuei looked on, occasionally offering a suggestion. Nina let her eyes study those two shoe faces next to each other. Wylan's manner and posture were utterly different, but when both boys were at rest, it was nearly impossible to tell them apart. "I did that," Nina thought. She remembered the sway of the ship's lanterns in the little cabin. Wylan's ruddy curls, disappearing beneath her fingertips to be replaced by a sheaf of thick black hair, his wide blue eyes, afraid but stubbornly brave, turning gold and changing shape. It had felt like magic, true magic, the kind in the stories the teachers at the little palace had told to try to get them to sleep. And it had all belonged to her. Inej came to sit beside her with two cups of hot tea in hand. "How are you this morning?" she asked. "Can you eat?"
"I don't think so."
Nina forced herself to take a sip of tea, then said,
"Thank you for what you did last night, for standing by me. It was the right thing to do. I don't want to see anyone else made a slave. Even so, you're very welcome, Nina Zenik. You may repay me in the customary way.
Waffles?
Lots of them.
You need them.
Benek didn't feed you, did he? I wasn't particularly obliging, but he tried for a while. And then? And then he decided to torture me."
Nina's fists clenched. "I'm going to string his innards up like party garlands." Inej laughed and settled her head on Nina's shoulder.
"I appreciate the thought. Truly. But that debt is mine to pay." She paused. "The fear was the worst of it. After the ice court, I almost thought I was beyond fear."
Nina rested her chin atop Inej's silky hair. "Zoya used to say that fear is a phoenix. You can watch it burn 1,000 times and still it will return."
The need for Perem felt that way too.
Matthias appeared in front of them.
"We should go soon. We have little more than an hour before sunrise."
"What exactly are you wearing?" Nina asked, staring at the tuft cap and woolly red vest Matthias had put on over his clothes.
"Kaz procured papers for us, in case we're stopped in the Rovkin Quarter. We're Sven and Katrine Ulfsen, Fjerdan detectors seeking asylum at the Rovkin Embassy."
It made sense. If they were stopped, there was no way Matthias could pass himself off as Rovkin. But Nina could easily manage Fjerdan.
"Are we married, Matthias?"
she said, batting her lashes. He consulted the papers and frowned.
"I believe we're brother and sister."
Jesper ambled over, rubbing the sleep from his eyes.
"Not creepy at all."
Nina scowled. "Why did you have to make us siblings, Brekker?" Kaz didn't look up from whatever document he was examining.
"Because it was easier for Spect to forge the papers that way, Zenik. Same parents' names and birthplace, and he was working to accommodate your noble impulses at short notice."
"We don't look anything alike."
"You're both tall,"
Inej offered. "And neither of us have gills," said Nina. "That doesn't mean we look related."
"Then tailor him,"
Kaz said coldly. The challenge in Kaz's eyes was clear. So he knew she'd been struggling. Of course he did. Dirty hands never missed a trick.
"I don't want to be tailored," said Matthias.
She had no doubt it was true, but she suspected he was also trying to salve her pride.
You'll be fine, said Jesper, breaking the tension. Just keep the soulful glances to a minimum and try not to grope each other in public.
She should be so lucky.
Here,
Matthias said, handing her the blonde wig she'd used for the smeat job and a pile of clothes.
These better be my size, Nina said grumpily. She was tempted to strip down in the middle of the tomb, but she thought Matthias might keel over from the sheer impropriety of it all.
She grabbed a lantern and marched into one of the side catacombs to change. She didn't have a mirror, but she could tell the dress was spectacularly dowdy, and she had no words for the little knitted vest. When she emerged from the passage, Jesper doubled over laughing, Kaz's brows shot up, and even Inej's lips twitched.
Saints, Nina said sourly. How bad is it?
Inej cleared her throat.
You do look a bit...
enchanting, said Matthias.
Nina was about to snap that she didn't appreciate the sarcasm when she saw the expression on his face. He looked like someone had just given him a tuba full of puppies.
You could be a maiden on the first day of Runningsgel.
What is Runningsgel?
Asked Kuei. Some festival, replied Nina. I can't remember. But I'm pretty sure it involves eating a lot of elk. Let's go, you big goon. And I'm supposed to be your sister. Stop looking at me like that.
Like what?
Like I'm made of ice cream.
I don't care for ice cream.
Matthias, Nina said. I'm not sure we can continue to spend time together.
But she couldn't quite keep the satisfaction from her voice. Apparently, she was going to have to stock up on ugly knitwear. Once they were clear of Black Veil, they followed the canals northwest, slipping in with the boats heading to the morning markets near the Stadthal. The Ravkin embassy was at the edge of the government sector, tucked into a wide bend in the canal that backed on a broad thoroughfare. The thoroughfare had once been a marsh, but had been filled in and bricked over by a builder who had intended to use the site for a large hotel and parade ground. He had run out of funds before construction could start. Now it was home to a teeming marketplace of wooden stalls and rolling carts that appeared every morning and vanished every evening when the Stadwatch patrolled. It was where refugees and visitors, new immigrants and old expatriates came to find familiar faces and customs. The few cafes nearby served pelmeni and salted herring, and old men sat at the outdoor tables, sipping kvass and reading their Ravkin news sheets, weeks out of date. When Nina had first been stranded in Ketterdam, she'd thought of seeking sanctuary at the embassy, but she was afraid that she'd be sent back home to where she was supposed to be serving in the Second Army. How could she possibly explain that she couldn't return to Ravka until she'd freed a Fjerdin Druskella she'd helped to imprison on false charges? After that, she'd rarely visited little Ravka. It was just too painful to walk these streets that were so much like home, and so unlike home at the same time. Still, when she glimpsed the golden Lansoff double eagle flying on its pale blue field, her heart leapt like a horse clearing a jump. The market reminded her of Oskervo, the bustling town that had served as capital to West Ravka before the unification. The embroidered shawls and gleaming samovars, the scent of fresh lamb being cooked on a spit, the woven wool hats and battered tin icons glinting in the early morning sun. If she ignored the narrow kirch buildings with their gabled roofs, she could almost pretend she was home. A dangerous illusion. There was no safety to be had on these streets. Homesick as she was, as Nina and Matthias passed peddlers and merchants, some small, shameful thing inside her cringed at how old-fashioned everything looked. Even the people, clinging to traditional Ravkin dress, looked like relics of another time. Objects salvaged from the pages of a folk tale. Had the year she'd spent in Ketterdam done this to her? Somehow changed the way she saw her own people and customs? She didn't want to believe that. As Nina emerged from her thoughts, she realized that she and Matthias were attracting some very unfriendly glances. No doubt there was quite a bit of prejudice against Fjerdins among Ravkins. But this was something different. Then she glanced up at Matthias and sighed. His expression was troubled, and when he looked troubled, he looked terrifying.
The fact that he was built like the tank they'd driven out of the ice court didn't help either.
Matthias,
she murmured in Fjordan, giving his arm what she hoped was a friendly, sibling-like nudge.
Must you glower at everything?
I'm not glowering.
We're Fjordans in the Ravkin sector. We already stand out. Let's not give everyone another reason to think you're about to lay siege to the market. We need to get this task done without drawing unwanted attention. Think of yourself as a spy.
His frown deepened.
Such work is beneath an honest soldier.
Then pretend to be an actor.
He made a disgusted sound. Have you ever even been to the theater?
There are plays every season in Jerholm.
Let me guess. Sober affairs that last several hours and tell epic tales of the heroes of yore.
They're actually very entertaining. But I've never seen an actor who knows how to properly hold his sword.
Nina snorted a laugh.
What?
Matthias said, perplexed.
Nothing, really.
Nothing. She'd educate Matthias on innuendo another time. Or maybe she wouldn't. He was so much more fun when he was completely oblivious.
What are those?
He asked, gesturing to one of the vendor's blankets. It was laden with tiny rows of what looked like sticks and chips of rock.
Bones, she said. Fingers, knuckles, vertebrae, broken bits of wrists. Saints' bones, for protection.
Matthias recoiled.
Rothkins carry around human bones?
You talk to trees. It's superstition.
Are they really meant to come from saints?
She shrugged.
Their bones sifted from graveyards and battlegrounds. There are plenty of those in Ravka. If people want to believe they're carrying Sankt Egmund's elbow or Sankt Alina's pinky toe...
Who decided Alina Starkopf was a saint anyway?
Matthias said grumpily.
She was a powerful Grisha. They're not the same thing.
Are you so sure?
Nina said, feeling her temper rise. It was one thing for her to think Ravkin customs seemed backward. Quite another to have Matthias questioning them.
I've seen the ice court for myself now, Matthias. Is it easier to believe that place was fashioned by the hand of a god, or by Grisha with gifts your people didn't understand?
That's completely different.
Alina Starkov was our age when she was martyred. She was just a girl, and she sacrificed herself to save Ravka and destroy the Shadow Fold. There are people in your country who worship her as a saint, too.
Matthias frowned.
It's not.
If you say natural, I'll give you giant buck teeth.
Can you actually do that?
I can certainly try.
She wasn't being fair. Ravka was home to her. It was still enemy territory to Matthias. He might have found a way to accept her, but asking him to accept an entire nation and its culture was going to take a lot more work.
Maybe I should have come alone. You could go wait by the boat.
He stiffened.
Absolutely not. You have no idea what might be waiting for you. The shoe may have already gotten to your friends.
Nina did not want to think about that.
Then you need to calm down and try to look friendly.
Matthias shook out his arms and relaxed his features.
Friendly, not sleepy, just pretend everyone you meet is a kitten you're trying not to scare.
Matthias looked positively affronted.
Animals love me.
Fine. Pretend they're toddlers. Shy toddlers, who will wet themselves if you're not nice.
Very well. I'll try.
As they approached the next stall, the old woman tending to it looked up at Matthias with suspicious eyes. Nina nodded encouragingly at him. Matthias smiled broadly and boomed in a sing-song voice.
Hello, little friend.
The woman went from wary to baffled. Nina decided to call it an improvement.
And how are you today?
Matthias asked.
Pardon?
The woman said.
Nothing, Nina said in Ravkin. He was saying how beautifully the Ravkin women age.
The woman gave a gap-toothed grin and ran her eyes up and down Matthias in an appraising fashion.
Always had a taste for Fjordans. Ask him if he wants to play princess and barbarian,
she said with a cackle.
What did she say?
Asked Matthias. Nina coughed and took his arm, leading him away.
She said you're a very nice fellow and a credit to the Fjerdan race.
Oh, look, Blini! I haven't had a proper Blini in forever.
That word she used. Babink, he said. You've called me that before. What does it mean?
Nina directed her attention to a stack of paper-thin buttered pancakes. It means sweetie pie.
Nina?
Barbarian.
I was just asking. There's no need to name-call.
No, Babink means barbarian. Matthias's gaze snapped back to the old woman, his glower returning to full force. Nina grabbed his arm. It was like trying to hold on to a boulder.
She wasn't insulting you, I swear.
Barbarian isn't an insult?
He asked, voice rising.
No. Well, yes, but not in this context.
She wanted to know if you'd like to play princess and barbarian.
It's a game?
Not exactly.
Then what is it?
Nina couldn't believe she was actually going to attempt to explain this. As they continued up the street, she said,
In Ravka, there's a popular series of stories about, a brave Fjerdan warrior.
Really?
Matthias asked.
He's the hero?
In a manner of speaking, he kidnaps a Ravkin princess.
That would never happen.
In the story, it does, and, she cleared her throat, they spend a long time getting to know each other. In his cave.
He lives in a cave?
It's a very nice cave. Furs, jeweled cups, mead.
Ah,
he said approvingly.
A treasure hoard like Ansgar the Mighty. They become allies, then.
Nina picked up a pair of embroidered gloves from another stand.
Do you like these? Maybe we could get Kaz to wear something with flowers, liven up his look.
How does the story end? Do they fight battles?
Nina tossed the gloves back on the pile in defeat. They get to know each other. Intimately. Matthias's jaw dropped.
In the cave?
You see, he's very brooding, very manly, Nina hurried on, but he falls in love with the Ravkin princess, and that allows her to civilize him.
To civilize him?
Yes, but that's not until the third book.
There are three?
Matthias, do you need to sit down?
This culture is disgusting. The idea that a Ravkin could civilize a Fjerdan.
Calm down, Matthias.
Perhaps I'll write a story about insatiable Ravkins who like to get drunk and take their clothes off and make unseemly advances toward hapless Fjerdans.
Now that sounds like a party. Matthias shook his head, but she could see a smile tugging at his lips. She decided to push the advantage.
We could play,
she murmured, quietly enough so that no one around them could hear.
We most certainly could not.
At one point he bathes her.
Matthias's steps faltered.
Why would he...
She's tied up, so he has to.
Be silent.
Already giving orders. That's very barbarian of you. Or we could mix it up. I'll be the barbarian and you can be the princess. But you'll have to do a lot more sighing and trembling and biting your lip.
How about I bite your lip?
Now you're getting the hang of it, Halvar.
You're trying to distract me.
I am, and it's working. You haven't so much as glared at anyone for almost two blocks. And look, we're here.
Now what?
Matthias asked, scanning the crowd. They'd arrived at a somewhat ramshackle-looking tavern. A man stood out front with a wheeled cart, selling the usual icons and small statues of Sancta Alina rendered in the new style. Alina with fist raised, rifle in hand, the crushed bodies of winged Volkra beneath her boots. An inscription at the statue's base read, Rebbe Dva Volkshaya, Daughter of the People.
Can I help you?
The man asked in Ravkin. Good health to young King Nikolai, Nina replied in Ravkin. Long may he reign.
With a light heart,
the man replied.
And a heavy fist, said Nina, completing the code.
The peddler glanced over his shoulder.
Take the second table to your left as you enter. Order if you like. Someone will be with you shortly.
The tavern was cool and dark after the brightness of the plaza, and Nina had to blink to make out the interior. The floor was sprinkled with sawdust, and at a few of the small tables, people were gathered in conversation over glasses of kvass and dishes of herring. Nina and Matthias took a seat at the empty table. The tavern door slammed shut behind them. Immediately, the other customers shoved away from their tables, chairs clattering to the floor, guns pointed at Nina and Matthias. A trap. Without pausing to think, Nina and Matthias leapt to their feet and positioned themselves back to back, ready to fight. Matthias with pistol raised and Nina with hands up. From the back of the tavern, a hooded girl emerged, her collar drawn up to cover most of her face. "Come quietly," she said, golden eyes flashing in the dim light. "There's no need for a fight." "Then why all the guns?" Nina asked, stalling for time. The girl lifted her hand, and Nina felt her pulse beginning to drop. "She's a heartrender!" Nina shouted. Matthias yanked something from his pocket. Nina heard a pop and a whoosh, and a moment later the air filled with a dark red haze. Had Weiland made a dusk bomb for Matthias? It was a Druskella technique for obscuring the sight of Grisha heartrenders. In the cover of the haze, Nina flexed her fingers, hoping her power would respond. She felt nothing from the bodies surrounding them. No life. No movement. But from the edges of her consciousness, she sensed something else. A different kind of awareness. A pocket of cold in a deep lake. A bracing shock that seemed to wake her cells. It was familiar. She'd felt something similar when she'd brought down the guard the night they'd kidnapped Alice. But this was much stronger. It had shape and texture. She let herself dive into the cold, reaching for that sense of wakefulness blindly, greedily, and arced her arms forward in a movement that was as much instinct as skill. The tavern windows crashed inward in a hail of glass. Fragments of bone shot through the air, peppering the armed men like shrapnel. "The relics from the vendors' carts," Nina realized in a flash of understanding. She'd somehow controlled the bones.
"They have reinforcements!"
one of the men yelled.
"Open fire!"
Nina braced for the impact of the bullets, but in the next second she felt herself yanked off her feet. One moment she was standing on the floor of the tavern, and the next her back was slamming against the roof beams as she gazed down at the sawdust far below. All around her, the men who'd attacked her and Matthias hung aloft, also pinned to the ceiling. A young woman stood at the doorway to the kitchen, black hair shining nearly blue in the dim light.
"Zoya?"
Nina gasped as she stared down, trying to catch her breath. Zoya stepped into the light, a vision in sapphire silk, her cuffs and hem embroidered in dense whorls of silver. Her heavily lashed eyes widened.
"Nina!"
Zoya's concentration wavered, and they all dropped a foot through the air before she tossed her hands up, and they were once more slammed against the beams. Zoya stared up at Nina in wonder.
"You're alive," she said.
Her gaze slid to Matthias, thrashing like the biggest, angriest butterfly ever pinned to a page.
"And you've made a new friend."
14. Weiland. Weiland hadn't been on a browboat of this size since he'd tried to leave the city 6 months ago, and it was hard not to remember that disaster now, especially when thoughts of his father were so fresh in his mind. But this boat was considerably different from the one he'd tried to take that night. This browboat ran the market line twice a day. Inbound, it would be crowded with vegetables, livestock, whatever farmers were bringing to the market squares scattered around the city. As a child, he'd thought everything came from Ketterdam, but he'd soon learned that, though just about anything could be had in the city, little of it was produced there. The city got its exotics, mangoes, dragon fruit, small fragrant pineapples from the southern colonies. For more ordinary fare, they relied on the farms that surrounded the city. Jesper and Wylan caught an outbound boat crammed with immigrants, fresh from the Ketterdam harbor, and laborers looking for farm work instead of the manufacturing jobs offered in the city. Unfortunately, they'd boarded far enough south that all the seats were already taken, and Jesper was looking positively sulky about it. "Why can't we take the Belent line?" Jesper had complained only hours before. "It goes past Olendal. The boats on the market line are filthy, and there's never any place to sit. Because you two will stand out on the Belent line. Here in Ketterdam, you're nothing to look at, assuming Jesper doesn't wear one of his brighter plaids. But give me one good reason, other than farm work, you'd see a shoe and a zemini traipsing around the countryside." Wylan hadn't considered how conspicuous he might be outside the city with his new face, but he was secretly relieved Kaz didn't want them on the Belent line. It might have been more comfortable, but the memories would have been too much on the day he would finally see where his mother had been laid to rest. "Jesper," Kaz had said, "keep your weapons hidden and your eyes open. Van Eck has to have people watching all the major transportation hubs, and we don't have time to fake up identification for Wylan. I'll get the corrosive from one of the shipyards on Imperium. Your first priority is to find the quarry and get the other mineral we need for the auric acid. You go to St. Hilda if and only if there's time." Wylan felt his chin lift, that simmering, stubborn feeling overtaking him. "I need to do this. I've never been to my mother's grave. I'm not leaving Kirch without saying goodbye." "Trust me, you care more than she does." "How can you say that? Don't you remember your mother and father at all?" "My mother is Ketterdam. She birthed me in the harbor. And my father is Prophet. I honor him daily. Be back by nightfall, or don't come back at all. Either of you. I need crew, not sentimental nubs." Kaz handed Wylan the travel money. "Make sure you buy the tickets. I don't want Jesper wandering off to take a spin at Mocker's Wheel." "This song is getting old," muttered Jesper. "Then learn a new refrain." Jesper had just shaken his head, but Wylan could tell Kaz's barbs still stung. Now, Wylan looked at Jesper, leaning back on the railing, eyes shut, profile turned to the weak spring sun. "Don't you think we should be more cautious?" Wylan asked, his own face buried in the collar of his coat. They'd barely dodged two Stadwatch as they'd boarded. "We're already out of the city." "Relax." Wylan glanced over his shoulder. "I thought they might search the boat." Jesper opened one eye and said,
"And hold up traffic? Van Eck's already making trouble at the harbors. If he jams up the brow boats, there'll be a riot."
"Why?"
"Look around. The farms need laborers. The plants need workers. The Kirch will only abide so much inconvenience for a rich man's son, especially when there's money to be made."
Wylan tried to make himself relax and unbuttoned the rough-spun coat Kaz had obtained for him. "Where does he get all the clothes and uniforms from anyway? Does he just have a giant closet somewhere?"
"Come here."
Warily, Wylan sidled closer. Jesper reached for his collar and flipped it, giving it a tug so Wylan could twist around and just make out a blue ribbon pinned there.
"This is how actors mark their costumes," Jesper said. "This one belonged to Joseph Kickert. Oh, he's not bad. I saw him in The Madman Takes a Bride."
"Costumes?" Jesper flipped the collar back, and as he did, his fingers brushed against the nape of Wylan's neck.
"Yup.
Kaz cut a secret entrance into the wardrobe rooms of the Stadlied Opera House years ago. That's where he gets a lot of what he needs and where he stashes the rest. Means he can never be caught with a fake Stadwatch uniform or house livery in a raid. Weiland supposed it made sense. He watched the sunlight flashing off the water for a while, then focused on the railing and said, "Thanks for coming with me today. Kaz wasn't going to let you go by yourself. Besides, I owe you. You came with me to meet my dad at the university, and you stepped in when he started getting inquisitive. I don't like lying." Jesper turned around, balancing his elbows on the railing and gazing out at the grassy banks that sloped down to the canal. "So why did you do it?" Weiland didn't really know why he'd made up that crazy story about luring Jesper into a bad investment. He hadn't even been totally sure what he was going to say when he opened his mouth. He just couldn't stand to see Jesper, confident, smiling Jesper with that lost look on his face, or the terrible mix of hope and fear in Colm Fahey's gaze as he waited for an answer from his son. It reminded Weiland too much of the way his own father had looked at him, back when he'd still believed Weiland could be cured or fixed. He didn't want to see the expression in Jesper's father's eyes change from worry to anguish to anger. Weiland shrugged. "I'm making a habit of rescuing you, for exercise." Jesper released a guffaw that had Weiland looking frantically over his shoulder again, afraid of drawing attention. But Jesper's mirth was short-lived. He shifted his position at the rail, scrubbed his hand over the back of his neck, fiddled with the brim of his hat. He was always in motion, like a lanky piece of clockwork that ran on invisible energy. Except clocks were simple. Weiland could only guess at Jesper's workings. At last, Jesper said, "I should have gone to see him today." Weiland knew he was talking about Colm. "Why didn't you?" "I have no idea what to say to him." "Is the truth out of the question?" "Let's just say I'd rather avoid it." Weiland looked back at the water. He'd started to think of Jesper as fearless, but maybe being brave didn't mean being unafraid. "You can't run from this forever." "Watch me." Another farmhouse slid by, little more than a white shape in the early morning mist, lilies and tulips stippling the fields before it in fractured constellations. Maybe Jesper could keep running. If Kaz kept coming along with miracle scores, maybe Jesper could always stay one step ahead. "I wish I'd brought flowers for her," Weiland said. "Something." "We can pick some on the way," said Jesper, and Weiland knew he was seizing the change in subject with both hands. "Do you remember her much?" Weiland shook his head. "I remember her curls. They were the most beautiful reddish gold." "Same as yours," said Jesper. "Before." Weiland felt his cheeks pink for no good reason. Jesper was just stating a fact, after all. He cleared his throat. "She liked art and music. I think I remember sitting at the piano bench with her, but it might have been a nanny." Weiland lifted his shoulders. "One day she was sick and going to the country so her lungs could recover, and then she was gone."
"What about the funeral?"
"My father told me she'd been buried at the hospital. That was all. We just stopped talking about her. He said it didn't pay to dwell on the past. I don't know. I think he really loved her. They fought all the time, sometimes about me, but I remember them laughing a lot together, too."
"I have trouble imagining your father laughing, even smiling, unless he's rubbing his hands together and cackling over a pile of gold."
"He isn't evil. He tried to kill you." "No, he destroyed our ship. killing me would have been an added benefit. That wasn't entirely true, of course. Jesper wasn't the only one trying to keep a step ahead of his demons.
Oh, then you're absolutely right, said Jesper. Not evil at all. I'm sure he also had good reasons for not letting you grieve for your mother.
Wyland tugged at a thread, unraveling from the sleeve of his coat. It wasn't all his fault. My father seemed sad most of the time, and far away. That was around the same time he realized I wasn't what he'd hoped for.
How old were you?
8, maybe? I'd gotten really good at hiding it.
How?
A faint smile touched Wyland's lips. He would read to me, or I'd ask one of the nannies to, and I'd memorize whatever they said. I even knew when to pause and turn the pages.
How much could you remember?
A lot. I sort of set the words to music in my head, like songs. I still do it sometimes. I'll just claim I can't read someone's writing and get them to read the words aloud, set it all to a melody. I can hold it in my head until I need it.
Don't suppose you could apply that skill to card counting?
Probably, but I'm not going to.
Misspent gifts.
You're one to talk. Jesper scowled.
Let's enjoy the scenery.
There wasn't much to look at yet. Wyland realized how tired he felt. He wasn't used to this life of fear, moving from one moment of worry to the next. He thought about telling Jesper how it had all started. Would it be a relief to have the whole shameful story out in the open? Maybe. But some part of him wanted Jesper and the others to keep believing that he'd left his father's house intending to set up in the barrel, that he'd chosen this life. As Wyland got older, Jan Van Eck had made it increasingly clear that there was no place for his son in his household, especially after his marriage to Alice. But he didn't seem to know what to do with Wyland. He took to making pronouncements about his son, each one more dire than the last.
You can't be sent to seminary because you can't read. I can't apprentice you somewhere because you may reveal yourself to be defective. You are like food that spoils too easily. I can't even put you on a shelf somewhere to keep without making a stink.
Then, 6 months ago, Wyland's father had summoned him to his office.
I've secured you a position at the music school in Belent. A personal secretary has been hired on and will meet you at the school. He will handle any mail or business beyond your capabilities. It is a ridiculous waste of both money and time, but I must accept what is possible where you are concerned.
For how long? Wyland had asked. His father shrugged.
As long as it takes people to forget I had a son.
Oh, don't look at me with that wounded expression, Wyland. I am honest, not cruel. This is best for both of us. You'll be spared the impossible task of trying to step into the role of a merchant's son. And I'll be spared the embarrassment of watching you attempt it.
I treat you no more harshly than the world will. That was his father's refrain. Who else would be so frank with him? Who else loved him enough to tell him the truth?
Wyland had happy memories of his father reading him stories, dark tales of forests full of witches and rivers that spoke. Jan Van Eck had done his best to care for his son, and if he'd failed, then the defect lay with Wyland. His father might sound cruel, but he wasn't just protecting himself or the Van Eck Empire. He was protecting Wyland as well. And everything he said made perfect sense. Wyland could not be trusted with a fortune because he would be too easily swindled. Wyland could not go to university because he'd be the target of mockery.
This is best for both of us. His father's ire had been unpleasant, but it was his logic that haunted Weiland. That practical, irrefutable voice that spoke in Weiland's head whenever he thought about attempting something new, or trying to learn to read again. It had hurt to be sent away, but Weiland had still been hopeful. A life in Belent sounded magical to him. He didn't know much about it, other than that it was the second oldest city in Kerch, and located on the shores of the Drunbeld River. But he'd be far away from his father's friends and business associates. Van Eck was a common enough name, and that far from Ketterdam, being a Van Eck wouldn't mean being one of those Van Ecks. His father handed him a sealed envelope and a small stack of kruger for travel money. "These are your enrollment papers, and enough money to see you to Belent. Once you're there, have your secretary see the bursar. An account has been opened in your name. I've also arranged for chaperones to travel with you on the browboat." Wyland's cheeks had flooded red with humiliation. "I can get to Belent. You've never traveled outside Ketterdam on your own, and this is not the time to start. Migson and Pryor have business to see to for me in Belent. They'll escort you there and ensure that you're successfully situated. Understood?" Weiland understood. He was unfit to even board a boat out of the city by himself. But things would be different in Belent. He packed a small suitcase with a change of clothes and the few things he would need before his trunks arrived at the school, along with his favorite pieces of sheet music. If he could read letters as well as he read a tablature, he'd have no problems at all. When his father had stopped reading to him, music had given him new stories, ones that unfolded from his fingers that he could write himself into with every played note. He tucked his flute into his satchel in case he wanted to practice on the trip. His goodbye to Alice had been brief and awkward. She was a nice girl, but that was the whole problem. She was only a few years older than Weiland. He wasn't sure how his father could walk down the street beside her without shame. But Alice didn't seem to mind, maybe because around her, his father became the man Weiland remembered from his childhood. Kind, generous, patient. Even now, Weiland could not name the specific moment when he knew his father had given up on him. The change had been slow. Jan Van Eck's patience had worn quietly away like gold plate over cruder metal. And when it was gone, it was as if his father had become someone else entirely, someone with far less luster. "I wanted to say goodbye and wish you well," Weiland said to Alice. She had been seated in her parlor, her terrier dozing at her feet. "Are you going away?" she asked, looking up from her sewing and noticing his bag. She was hemming curtains. Kerch women, even the wealthy ones, didn't bother with anything as frivolous as embroidery or needlepoint. Gazin was better served by tasks that benefited the household. "I'll be traveling to the music school at Belent."
"Oh, how wonderful!" Alice had cried. "I miss the country so much. You'll be so glad of the fresh air, and you're sure to make excellent friends."
She set down her needle and kissed both his cheeks.
"Will you come back for the holidays?"
"Perhaps," Weiland said, though he knew he wouldn't. His father wanted him to disappear, so he would disappear.
"We'll make gingerbread then," Alice said. "You will tell me all your adventures, and soon we'll have a new friend to play with."
She patted her belly with a happy smile. It had taken Wylan a moment to understand what she meant, and then he just stood there, clutching his suitcase, nodding his head, smiling mechanically as Alice talked about their holiday plans. Alice was pregnant. That was why his father was sending him away. Jan Van Eck was to have